This is Friday, the 23rd of December, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, a suspect in the terrorist attack in Berlin is gunned down in Italy. A tweet by the U.S. president-elect is causing concern among those against the proliferation of nuclear weapons. And we will talk with social media reporter Andrew Palczewski about Donald Trump's use of Twitter. And we check in with reporter Edward Uranian in Cairo about the Israeli leader contacting Donald Trump about a United Nations scheduled vote on settlements. It's all on today's International Edition. Germany's highest-ranking federal prosecutor is now saying investigators are trying to determine if the man suspected of carrying out a deadly truck attack at the Berlin Christmas market on Monday received help from a network of supporters. The suspect, 24-year-old Anis Amri, was fatally shot earlier today by police at a Milan, Italy train station during a routine patrol. Peter Frank, Germany's chief federal prosecutor, said authorities have confirmed that the shooting victim was the suspect in the attack that killed 12 people and injured 56 others. Even though the suspect, Anis Amri, has died, he said, we'll continue our investigation. Said that at a news conference in Berlin, going on to say it's very important for us now to find out whether there was a network of supporters and accomplices, whether there were confidants who helped and sought the person to prepare and conduct the attack and to escape. The Islamic State group has claimed responsibility for the attack, which it says was inspired through its call for people to strike members of a coalition that is fighting the militant group in Syria and Iraq. Well, a video released by the Islamic State group shows the Tunisian suspect pledging allegiance to its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and vowing to fight against what he calls the Crusader Pigs. The video, which appeared to have been taken by Anis Amri himself, shows him standing on a footbridge in the north of Berlin, not far from where he allegedly hijacked the truck used in the attack that killed 12 people and injured dozens more. The site is just a few hundred meters from a Berlin State Administration office that deals with asylum matters. It's unclear whether Amri's case was handled there or whether the video, released online on Friday, was taken before or after the attacks. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump tweeted Thursday that the United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capabilities until such time as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes. His team has been trying to clarify that statement ever since. U.S. State Department spokesman John Kirby could only speak to the Obama administration's nuclear policy on Thursday.
I can speak to is the approach that this administration has taken to trying to get us on a path to a world without nuclear weapons. First, reducing our stockpile and our launchers through New START. Number two, diminishing the role of nuclear weapons in our security strategy. And number three, securing the Iran deal.
Trump transition spokesman Jason Miller quickly said Trump was talking about the need to keep nuclear weapons away from terrorists and dangerous world leaders. Russian President Vladimir Putin told reporters Friday in his annual year-ending news conference that he sees nothing unusual in Trump's pledge. As for the newly elected U.S. president, said Mr. Putin, Mr. Trump, there is nothing new here. During his election campaign, he has spoken about the need to strengthen U.S. nuclear capabilities. Armed forces, there is nothing unusual about it. U.S. arms control expert says the U.S. and Russia possess roughly the same number of weapons in their nuclear arsenals, more than 7,000 each. But if Trump decides to expand the U.S. nuclear arsenal, it would be a sharp reversal of more than 50 years of U.S. policy, which is focused on cutting its nuclear stockpile. And we're just getting word in that Donald Trump is passing along what he says is a very nice letter that was sent to him by Vladimir Putin, the Russian president. The letter notes that serious global and regional challenges show that the relations between Russia and the U.S. remain an important factor in ensuring stability and securing in the modern world. The letter, which the Trump team describes as an unofficial translation, is dated December 15th. The text was sent as an attachment to a statement from Mr. Trump's transition team Friday. Trump said in a response that Putin's thoughts are so correct. adding he hopes both sides are able to live up to these thoughts and we don't have to travel an alternate path. The exchange comes on the heels of comments by both Trump and Putin about the need to strengthen their country's nuclear arsenals. Joining us, as promised, Andrew Palaszczuk, our social media expert. And this tweet by Donald Trump yesterday, that the United States must greatly strengthen and expand its nuclear capabilities until such time as the world comes to its senses regarding nukes, is just the latest in a series of very controversial tweets that he has. For those who really haven't been following that all this much, what's this all about? What is he doing different? And why do you think he's doing it?
Well, the thing that strikes me is that this harkens back to something that we heard in the campaign, which was, I think Hillary Clinton in one of the debates said, do we want the person to have the nuclear codes who gets upset over a Twitter comment or in a Twitter war? And I think that's kind of the crux of this, is that it's policy that could affect so many people. It's really scary policy to think about nuclear arsenals, potentially nuclear use of nuclear weapons, and to kind of just tweet this out on a medium that's so casual, but one that Donald Trump has used so effectively, it's kind of not sitting well with a lot of people. And then there's the issue, too, of a president-elect weighing in on policy like this and potentially trying to shift policy before being in office, which is unusual. So that is the crux of this issue with the nuclear tweet. There are also some tweets about some defense contracts and airplanes that were being built by Boeing and Lockheed Martin. And it's also very strange for a president to weigh in specifically on those kind of things and meet with those companies. Donald Trump, of course, had said that the Boeing contract for Air Force One, the presidential plane, was too expensive. He had gone after those two companies for spending too much money. So it's a very unusual relationship between these businesses and a president-elect.
We should say that we have made repeated attempts to get in touch with the Trump transition team to no avail. They have not gotten back to us whatsoever, but we did ask them to take part in this conversation. Now, the whole tweeting thing, number one, they say, the Trump supporters and Trump organization, that he's just doing things differently, that he is using what is now the means of communication, that instead of holding press conferences, that instead of, they didn't say instead of holding press conferences, but people are just kind of coming up with a possibility that instead of press conferences, instead of statements, instead of things like that, Twitter is the way to go.
This is the medium that he has consistently used because it's something that he's comfortable with. It's also the medium where he can get his words out directly to the American people without any kind of filter. And that's something that we've heard throughout the campaign and through the transition as well, is this idea of the mainstream media misinterpreting the poor coverage of Donald Trump. He's gone after NBC News, CNN here in the U.S. So this is an unfiltered way for him to get these thoughts out there. Now, that creates some issues when he does tweet out these controversial statements, and then there's a lot of parsing and sometimes even backtracking about what he said. But that's his way to connect with the American people. It's the way he's most comfortable. President Obama, it might have been, you know, in kind of a more of a town hall setting or more of a kind of a collegial atmosphere with journalists. But Donald Trump sees him more as an adversary. So he's going right to the American people. He's going to the people in the middle of the country, the middle class that are using Twitter, Facebook, other social media. And that's how he's reaching them.
Well, again, that brings up the whole conversation that we've been having for weeks now about the possibility of fake news or even news that it goes unchallenged by the media, which we view as the role of the media as the Fifth Estate. You go back to right after the election, this tweet: in addition to winning the Electoral College in a landslide, I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally. What?
Well, this is, you know, the double-edged sword of this is that you can put out whatever you want and reach out directly to the American people, but if it is blatantly false, it is going to be challenged and it is going to get covered in that way by the media. So even though you might not be going through the media, you might not be giving press conferences or interviews like a traditional president has in the past, you are still going to have your words parsed. You're still going to have your words examined and scrutinized.
For those who care to listen to that.
And that's the thing, too. It's if you have this group, as we've talked about consistently, that says, oh, it's the mainstream media. We're not going to follow them. They're biased. So they're going to take the words directly and think that that is the gospel of truth. In some cases, it may be. In some cases, it may not. And that's the back and forth that we have between this administration and the media, who's correct and who isn't. And that's, I think, something that we've seen in the past, but even more so now with the incorporation of social media. We've never had a president that has tweeted so freely. And so it's going to be interesting as those words come out, how they're parsed.
Well, there's also been the suggestion that maybe Twitter might want to do something to ban his account or watch his account better. They're not going to do that, are they?
No, I would be really surprised if they did that. I think that would create a huge firestorm for Twitter. I think it would create a huge firestorm about free speech, because while a lot of people say that they disagree with what Donald Trump says on Twitter, he is perfectly in the right as an American under the First Amendment to do so. I don't think that there's anything, at least not off the top of my head, I can recall that would be construed as violating Twitter's usage policy. So if they did ban it, it would be very unusual, and I think it would be a huge mess for them.
So what do you think? I don't know if anybody else cares about this, but I know you and I do. What do we as the media do about this, besides just what you suggested, just give the other side and hope that somebody cares?
I think that the thing that I'm already starting to see the media do, and I think it's going to be something we're going to see over the next 2, 3, 4 years, 4 years of this first term, is looking at who these people are and how they consume information. There was a lot of people in kind of the middle of the country, this middle class, a lot of these disaffected people that voted for Donald Trump that, like I said, are getting these words directly from him because they don't trust the media. Well, let's explore why they don't trust the media, how that has happened, how they consume this information, what they take as truth, what they don't. Oftentimes, as we've talked about again and again, these news articles that are put up on social media are actually false. It's false news, but it's being accepted as true.
Or so, it could be slanted one way or the other.
Or it could be slanted one way or another. So looking at all of that kind of media landscape and where the country stands, how people get information, how people receive information, and what they do with it. But I will say, just to our listeners, and just in my general thing that I tell people is always look at both sides. If you go to a conservative website consistently, go look at a left-leaning website and see what they're talking about.
People don't do that. You know that.
Exactly. But that's something people do need to do, because they need to see what both sides are saying. Even if they don't agree with it, they need to know where the other side is coming from. And I think that's part of the way that the country comes together after the divisiveness.
We as journalists can hope. That's what we can do.
That's my holiday wish and New Year's wish is that people will come together and maybe be a little more understanding in 2017.
Merry Christmas. Happy holiday
Merry
to
Christmas,
you.
Happy and, holidays to you
we'll
as well.
See,
happy
we'll
Hanukkah.
See you in a little bit.
And we'll see you soon.
Andrew Palczewski with us on International Edition. Among the top stories we are covering, Italian officials say the Tunisian man suspected of carrying out the attack on the Berlin Christmas market was shot dead by police at a train station in Milan Friday morning. Hijackers aboard a Libyan airplane surrendered themselves to police Friday after rerouting the plane to the island of Malta and releasing all hostages aboard. Donald Trump's selection of China critic Peter Navarro as the head of a new White House position focusing on trade is being seen by many in China as confirmation that the Republican leader is determined to implement trade restrictions on Chinese goods. Egypt has asked the United Nations to indefinitely postpone a vote on a resolution demanding an end to Israeli settlement building in Palestinian territories. More on that story in just a moment. Expanded coverage of all of these at voanews.com and VOA's mobile app. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array, or ALMA, is a collection of some 66 radio telescope antennas that work together to provide astronomers with a view of the earliest and most distant galaxies in the universe. Regions of space where these objects are located tend to be cold and dark and are difficult, if not impossible, to detect in visible light wavelengths. But these features can be seen clearly and brightly when they are observed in the millimeter and submillimeter wavelengths of the electromagnetic spectrum. Now, ALMA has received an upgrade with the installation of new Band 5 receivers to a select set of the array's antennas. These devices will make its observations in a whole new section of the radio spectrum and, among other things, will provide astronomers with a better way to look for signs of water in the nearby universe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
We continue on International Edition. Israel's prime minister turned to President-elect Donald Trump to help head off a critical UN resolution after learning that the White House did not intend to veto the measure. That according to an Israeli official. The admission marks a final chapter in the icy relations between Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and President Barack Obama over the last 8 years and signaled an era of close ties between Israel and the incoming Trump administration. At least that's what we think is happening here. We say hello in Cairo to Edward Uranian, VOA reporter. And Edward, is that how you read it, the same way?
There has been a great deal of talk in the Egyptian media of Egyptian Prime Minister Abdel Fattah al-Sisi intervening by withdrawing the resolution. And undoubtedly, President Trump and Mr. Sisi spoke in a phone call. Both Egypt and President-elect Trump have fairly good relations, fairly good ties, as all three men do with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as well. So I think, at least according to what we're reading in the tea leaves and what's been in the media here, that all three parties tried to short-circuit outgoing President Barack Obama.
As you see it, how might this change the political scenario between the United States, Israel, Egypt, and the Palestinians, factoring them in when Donald Trump takes office?
Well, the Arab media has often indicated that President Abbas, the Palestinian president, Palestinian Authority president, has been using the support, or what has been appeared to be the support of the Obama administration, to avoid getting into any direct negotiations with Prime Minister Netanyahu, that American pressure has in fact backfired in getting the two parties to negotiate. And now perhaps if Mr. Abbas feels that both Egypt, a traditional backer of the Palestinian Authority and of the Fatah movement, are withdrawing their support for this resolution, that they're looking for other ways to get the negotiations between Israel and the Palestinian Authority back on track, perhaps he'll be more amenable to coming to the table.
Edward Uranian, reporter for VOA, with us from Cairo. Edward, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Ira.
Edward Uranian, and we got this word in now that West African leaders say they're going to send troops into Gambia if its longtime ruler, who lost elections, doesn't step down next month, the president of the Economic Community of West African States said on Friday. New movie starring Oscar winners Kevin Costner and Octavia Spencer tells the true story of female engineers and mathematicians behind the U.S. space program. International Edition's David Byrd has more about the movie Hidden Figures.
Katherine Johnson is an African-American mathematician who worked as a computer at NASA in the early 1960s. She calculated flight trajectories for the Mercury Project, for the 1969 Apollo 11 flight to the moon, and she continued to work for the space agency into the shuttle age. Taraji P. Henson plays the mathematical genius. The Oscar-nominated actress says that when she learned of Katherine Johnson's life and influence, she felt cheated by her own experience.
That's why this movie was important to me, because I remember reading about it, and, you know, when I found out it was true, I was like, I was angry, because I was like, somebody stole a dream from me. Mm. Somebody stole an option from me. They lied to me.
Yeah. I will have you know, I was the first Negro female student at West Virginia University Graduate School. On any given day, I analyze the manometer levels for air displacement, friction, and velocity, and compute over 10,000 calculations by hand. So yes, they let women do some things at NASA, Mr. Johnson. And it's not because we wear skirts. It's because we wear glasses.
Octavia Spencer plays Dorothy Vaughn, a mathematician who arrived at the Langley Memorial Aeronautical Laboratory in Hampton, Virginia, and at the National Advisory Committee for Aeronautics, the predecessor to NASA. Vaughn headed a department made up entirely of African-American women. Spencer says the women's camaraderie helped them overcome both racism and sexism.
The camaraderie and the sense of community was very, very real back then. And I think we need to get back to that, mm-hmm. the sense yes. of community and the fidelity that women have yeah. with each mm-hmm. other.
Yeah.
Because Janelle says it all the time, that together we are stronger.
Janelle Monáe plays Mary Jackson, another mathematician at Langley and at NASA. Monáe says the women portrayed in the film had a strong sense of their destiny and worth.
I think that these women were able to vent and speak honestly and openly with each other and uplift each other when they got discouraged. But they didn't allow the racism or the sexism to get in the way of them pursuing their dreams. They knew their dreams were valid.
Jim Parsons, best known for his role in TV's The Big Bang Theory, says Hidden Figures shows how far a society can go if people work together, if they put aside the things that separate them from one another.
It almost sounds cliche saying that, but I think it's only that way because it's a lesson that needs repeating over and over and over again. And that's why I think that this movie is specifically about certain things at a certain time and about certain people, but it's equally applicable in different ways now, and it will be 20 years from now, you know.
Oscar winner Kevin Costner plays Al Harrison, the director of the Space Task Group.
What it reveals, what's hidden, are the women that were very much a part of NASA. You're seeing a male-dominated room most of the time in the movie, but what you come to realize is that there was women behind that. And in this instance, there was three African-American women who had a tremendous impact on what actually happened.
Hidden Figures has been nominated for a Screen Actors Guild Award for the cast and a Golden Globe for Octavia Spencer. The film is set for limited release in the United States Christmas Day. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for us. A happy holiday to all who are celebrating, whatever you are celebrating. You've been listening to International Edition. Find us at voanews.com. Like us at Facebook now. And follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks for joining us. Director Patrice Martin, thank you. Cornelius Titter, our engineer, thank you. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
To highlight International Human Rights Day in December, the United States government launched the hashtag #FreeToBeHome campaign, highlighting the stories of families and their loved ones who face politically motivated imprisonment for their beliefs and speech. This campaign, sponsored by U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Samantha Power, is profiling, through the holiday season, the cases of 10 prisoners unjustly held around the world and the families they leave behind. Political prisoners do not serve their sentences alone. Their absence is felt profoundly by family and friends, who too must serve out these punishments. They are sons and daughters, mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, and entire communities. The stories of these individuals highlight the broader struggle faced by so many families of political prisoners. Narges Mohammadi is one of the prisoners featured in the campaign. Ms. Mohammadi is a lawyer, human rights defender, and mother of two young children. She is currently serving a 16-year prison sentence for her peaceful activism, including her opposition to the death penalty. Ms. Mohammadi was previously a spokesman for Nobel Peace Laureate Shirin Ebadi's now-banned Center for Human Rights Defenders. She was an advocate for women's rights and for religious and ethnic minorities and political prisoners. When an appeals court in September upheld her outrageous 16-year sentence, international rights monitors denounced it. Human Rights Watch said the verdict was another example in Iran of the judiciary crushing dissent. Amnesty International called it yet another cruel and devastating blow to human rights in Iran, which demonstrates the authorities' utter contempt for justice. Narges Mohammadi is currently being held in notorious Evin prison. She has a history of seizures and loss of vision and requires specialized medical care, which has been denied her by the authorities. Her two young twin children have been awaiting her return. Her husband, Taghi Rahmani, has noted that every time Narges Mohammadi returned home, she filled the house with glowing and radiant cheerfulness everyone in the family now misses this light and warmth in their lives. The United States calls on the government of Iran to release Narges Mohammadi immediately and reunite her with her family. Like all political prisoners around the world, Narges Mohammadi, as Ambassador Power said, should be free to believe, should be free to be loved, should be free to be home.